Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, are medical devices causing nearly as many health problems as they're curing? We're smack dab in the middle of Medical Device Alley here in Minnesota. The industry accounts for thousands of jobs in the state and adds millions to the state's economy through companies like Medtronic and St. Jude's. But our guest says those companies benefit from a lax regulatory market and a lack of knowledge and research that's dangerous to the very people who are using the devices to treat or cure a disease. Investigative medical journalist Jean Lenzer writes in her new book, "The public and doctors often perceive these devices as advanced products of cutting-edge technology that are inert, and so unlike drugs, don't have serious side effects." Nothing could be further from the truth, and today we're going to talk about why. As Jean joins us, I'd like to hear from you. Have you had some experience of your own or someone in your family with a medical device, with an implanted medical device? Are there things that you wish you'd known about the device before it was implanted or used? So if you have some experience with a medical device, your own health, maybe someone in your family, I'd like to hear about that. But also, are there some things you wish you'd known before the device was implanted or used? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, and I've tweeted out a question about this. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Jean Lenzer is a trained physician's associate with an investigative medical reporter, and her new book is titled The Danger Within Us. She joins us today from Albany, New York. And Jean, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks. Hi. Thanks for having me.
I want to talk about cure as cause, because I think that's something that we have to understand at the beginning of this conversation. What do you mean when you use that phrase?
Well, drugs and devices interfere with the very same physiologic systems, body systems that is involved in the problem, in the disease. So when you interfere with the physiology and there's all sorts of feedback loops that is causing a problem, it's very easy to overshoot. It's very easy to reproduce the very symptoms you're trying to cure. So I give a number of examples in the book in which it's very difficult to discern whether the problem a patient is suffering is caused by their underlying disease or caused by the treatment.
I think it's important that you say in that quotation I read in the introduction that not just the public views these devices as inert, but doctors often do too. Why?
It's very difficult to tell on a one-to-one basis. And actually, one of the reasons I first became aware of this problem was I was fascinated when the Vioxx debacle happened. Mm-hmm. Vioxx is a pain reliever that was taken off the market after an FDA scientist determined that there were approximately 60,000 excess deaths from Vioxx. And it fascinated me. How could it be that we were killing people if we didn't notice it? And it's actually quite easy, in part because most doctors only see a few patients who may be affected out of their 1,000 patients. If you kill one out of 1,000, that may be lots of patients if you're treating tens of millions of people. But an individual doctor may not be aware of that. Also, it's impossible to tell on an individual basis. It's why we need clinical studies. Because if a patient who's 70 who takes Vioxx dies of a heart attack, how do we know they weren't just going to die of a heart attack anyway because of their age? And those are the people who tended to take Vioxx to treat their arthritis. So we need clinical studies, and that's really what I try to focus on in my book is, do we have proper science to know what works, what's safe, and what isn't?
I think that's also an important point that you've made before I go to some calls here, that an individual physician's individual experience, right? I've been implanting pacemakers. My patients have added, 10, 12 years to their lives. I haven't had serious problems with this. Is not a substitute for But have you looked at the overall peer-reviewed studies on this? Why aren't doctors more conversant with that kind of research, or don't we have that kind of research? Well,
that's exactly right. We don't have that kind of research in too many instances. We do in some, but, you know, doctors are often victims of this very problem. Some of them recommend devices based on the best available evidence. Unfortunately, the best available evidence is often next to nothing. And they don't know that because they have to rely on the FDA. They can't conduct their own studies, and they can't possibly read the thousands of pages that are submitted by manufacturers on every device. So they have to rely on the FDA to provide critical information about whether something's safe or not. And they tend to think that if the FDA did this review of thousands of pages of information, that a device is safe and effective. But that's just often not the case. And in fact, most devices get on the market because they were simply grandfathered in. They were never subjected to clinical trials.
Let's hear from some listeners here who I think have some experience with these devices. To Melissa in Lake Elmo. Hi, Melissa. How does this affect your family?
Well, thank you for taking my call. Yes, so there's a condition that's genetically related. It's called ARBD, or John Hopkins now calls it ARVC, so arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. Uh-huh. And the resolution to a lot of that, since it's not curable and it's progressive as you age, is an implantable device, as you're talking about, with leads that go into the heart, and it acts as a pacer, and it can also act as a defibrillator. And the interesting thing is a lot of it is trial and error, and one of the things that we've experienced with three members of the family, with our daughter, they added extra slack to the lead, anticipating physical growth.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, she didn't make the growth. And so we have all this extra slack, which kind of, if you will, vibrates around and can send miscalculations or readings to the device. And it's made her somewhat ill in the sense of she just doesn't feel right. It feels like a lot of fluttering going on in the heart muscle. You also could have lead integrity, which when the lead is severed or breaks, it can also send missed signals, and then the device can go off because it's a smart / dumb box. It can also act as a governor, and if it isn't, the threshold isn't set higher for the person's exercise regimen, it can feel like a governor, it can fatigue them out, and then in addition, it can also set the device off. Sometimes the thresholds are not even met, and my husband had his go off more than 10 times, and we had to actually ask the EMT to get the magnet, which is kind of a misnomer name, but a magnet to override the device so he wouldn't continue to get shocked.
So Melissa, let me say this. You're really speaking Jean's language here because she's written a lot about some of what you've described here. Jean, what kind of context can you add around that?
Yeah, well, I think, again, when you quoted me in the beginning saying that most people think of devices as inert, I thought of devices as inert, meaning that they didn't give out problematic drugs or chemicals or toxins that we have to worry about or cause side effects. And I think there's several things that your listeners might want to pay attention to when they're faced with the possibility of an implant, some of which really are wonderful and life-saving. But some of which can be deadly and cause enormous pain. These defibrillator shocks that she's talking about can be extraordinarily painful. So one of the problems is that when a device is implanted, you can't just stop taking it like a drug. If it delivers electrical shocks or delivers drugs in addition, which some of them do, they can be very difficult to either turn off or even remove. And the problem of the leads that she was talking about, there were leads from Sprint Fidelis that began to fracture and cause unnecessary shocks and some deaths. And when the company recalled those leads, 95,000 of them, people were faced with the problem of, do I get them taken out or do I risk that I'm going to have, you know, serious adverse event or death? And the problem is that 15 to 18% of patients who had them taken out suffered serious adverse events because lead wires, whether they're from pacemakers, defibrillators, vagus nerve stimulators, deep brain stimulators, spine stimulators, And the same is true of surgical mesh, become enmeshed in scar tissue. And when that happens, it can be impossible to remove these devices, and it can even be deadly. In fact, one surgeon described trying to take surgical mesh out of a patient like trying to take gum out of hair.
Wow. You know, in many cases, this is something else that was eye-opening about your book to me. I was not aware that it is up to the manufacturer of the device to decide whether a device was instrumental in causing an injury or a death. And if the, let's say, name of company, Medtronic St. Jude's, decides that their device was not instrumental in the death of somebody who had that device, they don't have to report it to the FDA. Do I understand that right?
That is correct. Now, there are some caveats to that, but I did ask why that rule existed, since it's an obvious conflict of interest.
Right.
I mean, companies have been fined over and over and over again. As of just yesterday, I saw yet another report of a company not reporting deaths of patients in clinical trials until after they did their roadshow for an $86 million IPO. So this is common. It happens all the time, the failure to report bad outcomes. Why would we let a manufacturer with a clear conflict of interest to be the one to determine whether a device was related to an outcome or not? Well, this is the reason I got. They said if a patient dies on a stretcher, a hospital stretcher, it probably has absolutely nothing to do with the stretcher, 99.9%. I mean, unless somebody pushed them down some stairs and the stretcher broke, I mean, you're not going to report that. And they don't want all those reports. And that was the rationale I was given for why we don't want all reports that may be trivial or unrelated. But it is a clear conflict of interest. Not only that, but what we need is to simply total up the total number of deaths, because there are some very surprising outcomes at times from drugs and devices. And I'll give you an example. The vagus nerve stimulator, which gives a shock, a small shock to the vagus nerve to prevent seizures, can also cause the heart rate to slow. And sometimes it slows so much that the patient passes out. Now, one might think that a car accident is not caused by a device. But in this instance, it turns out maybe it is. And what about a drowning? Well, maybe the patient passed out while they were swimming or in the bathtub. So we have to consider all deaths, I believe, and simply compare them to a control group. And that's what often isn't done. And indeed, with the VNS device, the vagus nerve stimulator, when I asked for the data that allowed the company to keep the device on the market, I found that the company had never collected death data, which is exactly why the FDA gave only conditional approval to the device, because during their deliberations about whether to approve the device, they decided that they were very concerned about a, quote, high rate of deaths among test subjects. And because of that concern about a high rate of deaths, they gave the device only conditional approval, telling the company that they had to collect safety data afterwards. And yet the company never did.
So,
and the FDA did nothing.
Could there be a clearinghouse, I guess, of some ways that if the FDA is concerned about being inundated with deaths that potentially have nothing to do with, you know, just overall reports of death, could there be some clearinghouse where when a death occurs, where there's a question as to whether the device might have been involved, it goes to this place and then it's examined and then it goes to the FDA? Or is that impractical?
No, I think it's absolutely practical. I mean, we have the technology to do that and much, much more, and yet it hasn't been done. For years, more than a decade, the FDA has been diddling about with unique device identifiers for devices so that we can track them. As I often say, you know, Walmart can track every head of lettuce on its shelves and tell how many heads of lettuce they have to replace at any given moment. Yet the FDA's database, which, by the way, they purged as of 10 years ago, there used to be data reaching back 20 years or more. They purged the prior 10 years, which makes no sense at all. But they could easily track not only how many deaths there are, But really important, we need to know how many patients are implanted with the devices. Because a couple deaths among a large number of people is one thing. Thousands of deaths among a small number of people is another thing. And yet the FDA doesn't require manufacturers to tell how many patients are implanted.
This is a conversation, if you've just joined us, about the regulatory and the research environment around medical devices. Jean Lenzer is with us. She's out with a book called The Danger Within Us, America's Untested, Unregulated Medical Device Industry, and One Man's Battle to Survive It. We thought this was a really important conversation to have because of where we sit in the country, right? They call this Medical Device Alley in some ways, and we have a lot of manufacturers here, and it is best for individuals and physicians and the companies themselves to understand what's happening with regulations and with research. But an informed consumer, that's what you want to be, right, when you're making decisions around this. So I'm asking you if you've had some experience with this, someone in your family has, with a medical device. Are there some things you wished you'd known about the device before it was implanted or used? I think I'm hearing from some of you on that. If you're a physician, I think this would be an important part of the conversation as well. Do you feel like you have a good understanding of the regulatory and the research around some of these devices that you're using? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. To someone who wants to be anonymous in Maplewood, good morning. Hi.
Good morning.
Give me a sense of what you're thinking about here.
Yes, I work at one of the medical device manufacturers and in testing the devices and the materials. And I just wanted to say that I think there have been some improvements in the industry. More toxicological assessments are being done on the materials that they're using, as opposed to in the past, there was much more of a reliance on only animal testing and the survival in the animal. And now it's a more complete picture of the tox risk that the patient may face when these materials are being used or changed or as these products are being developed. I also wanted to say from the patient side, because my husband received a medical device last year, mm-hmm. that it's a little frustrating from the patient side because the patient has no control or really no knowledge sometimes
of
what devices are being used and if the manufacturer is reputable or if they've had issues in the production of these devices. And so the patient is kind of just at the doctor's mercy,
right?
In that regard.
Can I ask you one follow-up question? You said that there's research, better research on the tox rate. Does that address some of what Jean has been talking about with, you know, the actual the details of the way the device works, right? The way it integrates with your body, not just how your body may react to the presence of that device.
So I think, and I'm not familiar with the book, sorry, but I think it's twofold. So much of the animal testing, and there are even a lot of developments to advance in this regard, is the physiological side. So in terms of like the leads and how they interact within the body. And, you know, there's a lot of research on that side. But the other side is the looking at the chemicals and all of the things that are going to be absorbed by the body and how that will impact the patient and the toxicological effect that that will have.
Okay. So, Jean, and thanks very much for calling in. Really good to have your perspective from someone who works in the industry. Jean, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that's good if they are indeed doing more toxicological testing. The problem is that industry fails to provide relevant clinical information. What I mean by that is they will say they provide tons of data, and they do. They provide volumes and volumes of data binders, but they aren't clinical trial data. So, for example, Diana Zuckerman of the National Center for Health Research and her colleagues conducted a study of 50 devices for which the manufacturers provided data to the FDA. And these were for moderate and high-risk devices. And yet none provided studies of how the devices functioned inside people after the devices were implanted. Mm-hmm. Instead, well, I shouldn't say none. I'm going to back up on that a little bit, but it isn't much. Instead, they submitted data on the materials used or how the device operated in bench testing outside of a person's body, not how it functioned inside humans. And that's where we need clinical trials. So of the 50 devices they looked at, only three provided clinical information, and of those, even those clinical data were not necessarily the kind of data we needed.
Okay.
So, go ahead.
So, Jean, I want you to hear this specifically because you just were emphasizing the clinical research. Clarissa is tweeting in, your guest has not clarified on air that safety testing is required on medical devices. And the more serious, important the device is, the more testing that's required. And then she says pacemaker versus topical bandage. The FDA requires that data in a risk assessment and can audit the manufacturing. And then she continues, there is a standard that governs safety of medical devices. A huge amount of toxicological, analytical, and clinical testing goes into the development and manufacturing of medical devices. You're saying they're lagging on the clinical testing.
Absolutely. And I challenge her to provide the information showing that devices are indeed approved. Every study that's been done so far about this issue shows that it simply isn't true. In fact, the Institute of Medicine recommended throwing out the entire system by which the FDA clears most medical devices, which is the 510K system. So I'll mention that. 510K is a mechanism by which manufacturers can name a device that's on the market and say, our device is sort of like that one, and they call it a predicate device, say that it's substantially equivalent. And as long as they say it's substantially equivalent to a device that's already on the market, the FDA clears it. Now, that is the overwhelming majority of implanted devices. Only 1% go through a more, quote, rigorous process, and I'll get to that because it's far from rigorous. But when we talk about 510K and saying that they cite a predicate device, the question is, was the predicate device ever shown to be safe and effective? And the answer to that is a resounding no, because the way these devices got on the market was that in 1976 was the date that the FDA first took over regulatory control of devices. And since there were already lots of devices on the market, pacemakers, stimulators, what they did is they just said, we'll grandfather all of you in. And from there on, manufacturers could cite a predicate device and say, ours is just like it, as if that proves it's safe and it's and effective. Yet IOM and a Supreme Court ruling indicated that it has nothing to do with safety and efficacy.
And to be clear here, just again, when you're talking about the predicate devices, you're saying there that's also where the research is missing. So if you're coming in with a secondary device to say ours is just like that, you are not having to you are not having to be accountable with the deep kind of clinical.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me grab a call here from Chris in Cottage Grove. Hey, Chris, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Oh, that's okay, Carrie. Thank you. And thank you to Ms. Lenzer for her book, which I have at the top of my stack to read. I had a St. Jude pacemaker defibrillator implanted in October of 2015, and unfortunately, it has the faulty battery design, which led to the FDA, is it class one, I think, or class A recall a little bit ago. And my complaint is against St. Jude's for not recalling the devices when they made the battery design change in May of 2015. For not recalling the devices that were in existence at the time, but not yet implanted in patients. And then I never would have received that one because mine was implanted 5 months after the design change. Instead, they, according to an article by Star Tribune's Joe Carlson, they continued to implant these, to ship these, for 17 months after the design change?
Chris, it's a good question about recalls. I want to go to another call, and then we'll tackle a couple of these points. To John in Minneapolis. Hi, John. What's your thinking on this?
Well, I think that the deregulatory environment that is actually decades, it's not just recent, has contributed to this kind of problem. And also, the Food and Drug Administration is often headed by people who have been in the industry. And this is an ongoing issue, probably from its inception.
So, Gene, on this issue of recalls, and is what John is saying contributing to the fact that there isn't enough regulation around recalls?
Yeah, I think both of your speakers have really hit the nail on the head here. It's typical of companies to not withdraw dangerous devices when they learn of harms and to delay that. And when they do withdraw the devices, was the case with a hip implant, they simply say, well, there weren't enough sales. They don't mention that there was cobalt poisoning. And the deregulatory environment is indeed the problem. And he's right. It's been going on for ages, and it's getting much worse now. And in fact, it reminds me of a wonderful phrase that the FDA uses in its approval of devices, and that is that they are supposed to abide by the, quote, least burdensome rule. Now, who are they talking about when they talk about least burdensome? It's not about not burdening the public with dangerous devices and making sure that you have registries that are mandatory, that we track every device. It's least burdensome to industry so that we do the least amount that is going to disturb their profits.
Jean Lenzer is with us. If you've just tuned in, she's a medical investigative reporter and a trained physician's associate, and her new book is called The Danger Within Us. Jean, I want to get to this question of fines here before we go back to the calls. I don't understand why these companies seem to be fairly sanguine about paying out hundreds of millions of dollars in fines. I mean, you've mentioned Medtronic paying out millions for kickbacks to doctors, making false claims, selling devices that weren't approved for a specific use, and they're not alone. Do they just factor this in as kind of, well, this is part of what it means to be a manufacturer in this industry?
Absolutely. If you read their SEC filings, they just include it as a regular part of the cost of doing business. And it's not just that they get a single fine. It's that they get them over and over and over again annually. I mean, this is just not unusual. And FDA has been doing very little to stop any of this.
And you say that the civil and criminal penalties really don't do much to slow down sales. Why?
Well, there have been virtually no criminal penalties. There have been some, but almost never. They're largely fines, and those they can pass off. I mean, their profit margins are so massive that it's easy to just pay that out rather than deal with the issues. And, you know, one of the problems is people say, well, the demands that I and others like me make about pre-market testing, meaning that we should do better clinical trial testing before things are put on the market. So it's not like the VNS device and other devices that are given conditional approval because of concerns about deaths, that in fact we should study those things before they're on the market. And when there's uncertainty, and even when there isn't that much uncertainty, even when something seems safe, there should be some mandatory registries. They exist in Europe and Japan and Australia. We have no mandatory registries in the United States.
And why would that be? I mean, is that the influence that the industries themselves are wielding over
industry,
this?
Industry, yes, has been so powerful. And they lobby Congress, and they also line the war chests of our politicians. And what's amazing is that so few people know about something called DeviceGate. So DeviceGate occurred a few years back when FDA scientists were getting very frustrated because they were unanimously recommending against approval of a number of devices that they said were unsafe and ineffective. And despite the scientists' unanimous agreement that certain devices shouldn't be approved, phone calls were made from congresspeople to FDA managers, and FDA managers overruled the scientists.
Wow. A call here from Sean in Painesville. Sean, thank you so much for waiting. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was just calling. I know we've heard a lot of stories of people who maybe didn't have all the information. I just wanted to share my wife's experience.
Go ahead.
She had the NeuroPace responsive neurostimulator implanted in 2015 for her epilepsy. And as part of that, we really underwent almost a full year's worth of research and consultation with her epileptologist at the University of Minnesota.
Good.
Who shared with us a lot of the data that had been accumulated before the FDA approval. And he shared with us the findings of the whole study surrounding that and showed us how to find that. And I think one of the biggest things that we learned from that is to not be afraid to ask questions. All too often, I think as patients, we just trust what our doctors are telling us. And really, we need to be able to learn to just ask a question if we have it, especially for something as serious as this.
You felt fully informed as a couple when your wife went in to make the decision to have this.
Absolutely.
That's good.
Yeah.
Oh.
And we went in with the expectation of looking at an RNS or even medical marijuana, and he pointed us towards this device and fully explained why and what happened.
Good to have your experience, Sean, in the discussion. Glad you waited. A call here from someone who wants to be anonymous in Minneapolis. I assume, again, you work in the medical device industry. Is that right?
Yeah. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
Do. And I'm also have a long family history of medical device use and implants for various health issues, and that's actually part of the reason that I'm in the industry.
Uh-huh.
But I've got a couple of things I'd like to just cover. So on the point about being educated about what device you're choosing, what device that your physician chooses to use on you, you're absolutely right. That's extremely important. And I would say that from the perspective of the industry, we could never design a device good enough to get over the inattention or the inexperience of the person using it and implanting it or programming it or whatever it may be. So doing your due diligence on the device itself, doing your due diligence on the physician that you're working with to be treated, hugely important from a patient perspective.
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying here. Are you saying that a number of the problems that are developing from these devices are because the physicians don't know what they're doing, or the people that are programming the devices don't know what they're doing? That's where the problem
is? Medical technology has become extremely complex, right? And just like a lot of other things, whether it's a car that you buy or something that you buy for your home, you're only going to get the most out of that device or that machine if you know how to use it correctly. And,
I know you
have a massive burden here.
This is a big point, I know you have a couple of them, but I'd like to have Jean respond to that, whether her research verifies that. Is that right, Jean?
Well, there's a Supreme Court ruling, and gosh, I'm just blanking on the name of it right now. It was in 2008, Regal v. Medtronic. And that was a famous ruling because it preempts patients from suing manufacturers if the device was approved by the FDA and functioned as intended. Now, the problem is a lot of devices function as intended and still can cause serious harms. So this was a stunning ruling that was, of course, favored by industry. They really wanted it to protect themselves. But what's interesting about that ruling was that it was triggered by a man who had a balloon angioplasty, meaning a catheter was threaded into his coronary artery. And when the doctor pumped up the balloon ruptured and sent the man into a serious heart attack, heart failure. He had to go into ICU and died 4 years later. Well, what the company argued, what Medtronic argued, was that it wasn't their fault that the balloon blew up,
mm-hmm.
that it was the cardiologist's fault for blowing up the balloon too far. Now, the problem is that 95%, more than 90% of spinal devices, I'm going to switch to another example, more than 90% have been shown to be used off-label. That means that they never won approval for the specific use that they were put to. And while industry encourages this in a multitude of ways, even though they're not allowed to legally advertise for it, what they do is they do encourage doctors, they train them in how to implant these devices, and when something goes wrong, they blame the doctor or they blame the patient. But it's never them.
Let me go back to the caller. And, sir, so your second point on this was what?
Well, I think the other thing that really struck me here is the vast oversimplification that's been presented about the 510K process. So, again, working in industry, the author makes it sound like we can simply send a letter to FDA and then the next day we have a device approved. It doesn't work that way. There's a vast process within FDA behind the 510K process. And, you know, especially for devices that are not permanently implanted, that are used as tools or as adjunctive devices during medical procedures, you know, even for those sorts of devices that have a relatively lower risk in terms of the time of implant and how long that person's going to be living with it, that process still applies, and it is extremely, extremely rigorous.
Okay.
And there's a lot of data that needs to be presented to demonstrate the safety and effectiveness of the device as compared to a predicate.
So, Gene,
just a little bit of a caution there not to oversimplify some of these regulatory processes.
Are we underemphasizing the process that the FDA goes through? Again, hearing what you said about what you think is a dearth of clinical trial information, what about the rest of what our caller is saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think it must be frustrating for people in industry who know that they have to provide these reams of material to FDA to hear me just write it off and say, you're not providing clinical information. But in truth, in the end, while they provide tons of answers to bureaucratic questions and provide information about the materials used, what was the predicate device, et cetera, what we don't see are the sort of clinical trials that tell us whether a device is safe and effective. So I'm going to give you an example. Rita Redberg, a cardiologist and an editor of Journal of the American Medical Association, Internal Medicine, published a study of the highest risk cardiac implanted devices. So here are heart devices implanted, the highest risk, and only 5% of them underwent the kind of clinical trials that even approach the kind of testing that's needed for drugs. And even that 5% wasn't sufficient in some instances.
Jake is saying on Twitter, if your guest is correct about there being no clinical trial data available, and Jake, she didn't say no, but she said that not enough. What does my wife do all day? Since her job is to publish clinical trial data for a major device manufacturer, they have to sell these things to doctors. Doctors need that data too.
The studies are studies. I mean, they're very clear. When researchers have looked at the information provided to FDA, which is what the National Center for Health Research did, it's what the Institute on Medicine did, it's what Rita Redberg and her colleagues published in JAMA, these things clearly show that clinical trial testing, that is, studies of the devices as they function inside people and compared with a control group, simply are non-existent in almost all circumstances. And in fact, the study done by Zuckerman from the National Center goes through each device, and you can read in her supplement about each device and what information was provided or not provided.
Gene, an earlier caller mentioned concern about conflicts of interest between the industries and the regulators, and I think he said that many of the industry people end up in high positions like at the FDA and other regulators. This is something that you're worried about, a very cozy
yes.
relationship between the two. What's the outcome of that?
Well, it is DeviceGate. It is when managers overrule their own scientists, especially after they've gotten phone calls from a legislator whose funding just happens to come from various drug and device manufacturers. It's a serious problem, and in fact, the as the earlier caller pointed out, this existed long before this administration. And Dan Troy was one example of somebody who was brought in from industry, moved to FDA long enough to promote the whole preemption ruling, the Supreme Court ruling saying you can't sue manufacturers, and then left to go back to industry.
Well, but let me ask you this. I mean, yeah. could an argument be made that, yes, we're bringing people in from the industry because they are the ones that really understand, you know, how this works? We want people to come in with this kind of inside knowledge.
Sure, we need inside knowledge, but that knowledge should go through a filter, and that filter has to be something that provides a bulwark between profiteering and the public health and public safety. So the question is, why aren't they bringing in experts from something like, say, Public Citizen or the National Center for Health Statistics or mm-hmm. the Lown Institute or all these groups that are interested in protecting the public interest? Instead, it's industry so that they can get their devices on the market faster and easier. The other thing is they're really undermining, with the 21st Century Cures Act, they're undermining the very concept of what constitutes science. Science in medicine is supposed to be when you do a randomized controlled trial and you say, we're going to put this device in a certain number of people, and we're going to compare the outcomes to a control group, to an appropriate control group. That's the only way you can tell whether a device is doing good or doing net harm. Mm-hmm. And yet, what 21st Century Cures Act recently passed now allows is for device companies to just say, well, we have a case where somebody got better. And one of the things that I outlined in my book was how FDA received testimony from five patients in a row about how wonderful this device was. It was life-saving. It was fantastic. And what I said was, you know, gee whiz, these patients weren't just plucked randomly from patients who were implanted. These were patients who were selected by industry and a third party that was supposed to be independent, but was funded by industry.
I was going to say here, Daniel in Minneapolis says, in 2013, I had a propylene mesh implanted in me due to a hernia. For years, I was in pain. Finally, I had it taken out last year. The doctor who took it out told me I was done a disservice, given the lack of information that I was given. And to the phones here to Bruce in Minneapolis. Bruce, you're a physician?
Yes, I'm a career emergency physician, and the disclosure, Jerry Hoffman introduced me to you about 15 years ago at a meeting.
Okay.
A long-term fan of outcome analysis and actually looking at what do we know. We distrust manufacturer-supported research, drugs in, you know, and medical devices, because their job is to sell drugs and devices. I almost never make a decision of what I probably never made a decision of what sort of hip replacement or pacemaker to put in, but I deal on a regular basis with symptoms that I simply can't tell.
All right.
Is the device causing a problem? Is it inert? Is it, you know, and there is not an evidentiary basis. Calls to the manufacturer are never helpful.
Bruce, I think this is a really good point. Gene, you know, a doctor like Bruce in the ER trying to make a decision about what is causing the symptoms, where do they turn for that kind of information? I mean, you could have somebody who's in, you know, critical condition. This is something you need to know.
Yeah. And again, it's very difficult to discern on an individual basis. So say you have somebody with a hip implant that's leaking cobalt and destroying the tissue around the hip. Is their hip pain caused by the underlying condition that led them to have an artificial hip? Or is it the hip itself? When somebody has a filter placed in a large vessel that goes to the heart to prevent clots from getting to the lungs, does that device actually cause clots, or is it preventing clots when somebody has a thrombosis. So, you know, it can be very difficult to tell. And that's my plea for better clinical trials, because everything is just a matter of chance. And I want to say that, you know, one surgeon told me once, he said, you know, manufacturers could sell us a piece of curtain that they cut off and tell us it's surgical mesh, and we wouldn't know the difference. I mean, this is the problem, is that, you know, there are doctors who are unfortunately benefiting and profiteering by implanting and promoting some of these devices, some of them to the tune of literally tens of millions of dollars to certain individual doctors. But many other doctors mean well.
Right.
They are relying on the medical evidence that's at hand because they don't have any other information. But as your caller just pointed out, the medical evidence that's provided is largely provided by industry now. And typically, they don't include negative outcomes, but do include anything positive.
Jean, one last question here before we have to close. As a patient, how do you do your best due diligence if you are headed down the road for, you know, the implantation of one of these devices? What do you do? Just simply, if you're not Jean Lenzer, what do you do about it?
Well, even if you're a physician, it can be very difficult to figure out what to do. One starting place is to contact some of the organizations and patient groups that I list on my website that are independent of industry. One of those organizations is the National Center for Health Statistics, which does some work on devices, the Right Care Alliance, and other organizations that are listed there, and hopefully people can get some help.
So you would be able to go online and through maybe some of these organizations and look at the safety record of the, I don't know, the pacemaker that you're thinking about having put in. You could do that.
Sometimes. Unfortunately, I hate putting this on the shoulders of individual patients, because I've had a number of doctors contact me, including one I included in the book, and even inside experts from Medtronic who've been harmed by their own devices. They didn't know how to choose a good device. So it can be, I really think that the starting point is to make policy changes and social and political change, which is what some activists are doing now. Women implanted with the eSure device, people implanted with surgical mesh, getting together and organizing.
Gina, a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Jean Lenzer's book is called The Danger Within Us. I've been hearing from some of you who are looking for the shows that I did with Kate Bowler and Mira T. Lee. With Kate, it was having an incurable cancer diagnosis and living with Grace. You can hear that conversation, stream it on the website, find it on the podcast. Same with that discussion with Mira T. Lee. All there when you're ready to listen.